take the scenic drive to the Guitar Oasis Cool in Jefferson County. Jeff's Guitar Clinic, jeffsguitar.com.
Welcome to another podcast. It's liesoffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers. Joining us now, John Nichols, Associate Editor of the Capital Times, also correspondent for The Nation. All right, so, brother, we had a Supreme Court race on Tuesday where three candidates squared off. Michael Skrenik, Rebecca Dallet, and Tim Burns. Obviously, not a good night for Tim Burns.
No, I mean, Tim Burns tried a what would best be described as a political experiment. He tried to run for state Supreme Court as somebody who was very blunt about his ideology, his values, his positions on a host of issues. And I think that it's possible we will come to the point where that's the reality of our court races. I think we're reasonably close to that because of the incredible involvement of, you know, all sorts of special interests in these races. But at the heart of it, Wisconsinites still appear to want to have, you know, their candidates for Supreme Court to be people with judicial background who at least go through the motions, and we can talk about some of the other candidates in a moment, but go through the motions of suggesting an impartiality. Now, the reality is that I think that Tim Burns, who you mentioned, would have been a very impartial judge. I think he would have, because he was so open about his values out front, my sense is that he would have served on the court as a genuinely independent player, unlike some of these people who go on the court and try to, you know, just absurdly try to hide their partisanship.
Now, he was criticized by Rebecca Dallet for describing himself as a Democrat. In some states, the Supreme Court justices are actually members of the party.
Pennsylvania.
You know, I remember after Michael Bolandic was defeated as mayor of Chicago, he ended up on the Illinois State Supreme Court.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, states all over the country, that's very common. And, you know, the truth of the matter is, look at who Trump appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court, Gorsuch, right?
I try not to think about that.
You're going to have to sometime soon, I'm afraid. Gorsuch is he's literally raised in Republican conservative politics. I mean, to the point of, as a child, going to doors with his mother. Mm-hmm. You know, he's part of Republican lawyers groups. He organized Republican lawyers for Bush when Bush was president. You know, I mean, just like one of the most deeply partisan records.
Well, same with Roberts.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, these are people who have deep, deep, hardcore partisan records. It's not like, you know, yeah, you know, you're a college professor or even a lawyer who has liberal leanings or conservative leanings. Many of these folks are hardcore partisans. That certainly Gorsuch was. But it's an interesting thing that when Gorsuch was going through his confirmation, he dumbed it down. He's like, you know, I don't really, are there two parties in America? I'm not sure. You know? And they do this. I mean, this is the game they play, and they play it in Wisconsin as well. But so Burns tried that. Dallet tried a little more, you know, kind of traditional route. You know, she's a sitting judge, talked about, you know, not identifying with the party and stuff like that. Except here's the interesting dynamic, as you notice, and I think a lot of people noticed during the campaign. As Burns started to deliver his message and get some traction, get some major endorsements and, you know, have at least some interest in his candidacy, Dallet changed. Dallet shifted. And she put that ad up, I mean, her much-talked-about TV ad, in which it started out with Donald Trump. And effectively, Dallet ended up, at the close, running, in some ways, a more classically, I wouldn't necessarily say partisan, but at least political campaign than Burns did.
You know, it was a good ad, and it kind of reminded me of Geraldine Ferraro and her daughters, you know, in an ad together. I thought that was quite an effective ad, and obviously I don't like Rebecca Dallet, but I thought that was a very good ad.
Whether you like Dallet or not, that's not the point.
No, I'm just saying. I'm not particularly fond of her, but I can objectively say that her ad was pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, the point is that we saw some things happen in this race that are pretty fascinating, and they're significant for where stuff goes forward, because Rebecca Dallet made it very, very clear that in this era of Trump, she will stand up for people's rights, she will, you know, stand up for the rule of law. That was her message she delivered. And that worked. I think it was very effective. I think it will be significant going forward, because she obviously was nominated, along with Michael Skrenek, the very, you know, hyper-partisan, by far the most partisan of the contenders.
By the way, did you see his victory party last night in the Dells?
I did not. I was.
I have seen it. Yeah. It looked like a gathering at the Crest Funeral Home.
Really? Yeah.
Yeah. It was like Glenn Grothman's victory party, where all the old people were sitting down. And he was very, very dull. By the way, I think he did a lot better than a lot of people thought he was going to do last night.
I agree. I think that, you know, because he barely campaigned, right? And Michael Skrenek is a very good measure of the power of money, right? I mean, Michael Skrenek made no impression at all. I mean, he didn't try, and nobody knew who he was, knew anything about him. He's just he's a Republican Party, you know, operative who became a lawyer. He's got a Walker appointment. Now he's going for judge. It's the oldest story in the book.
He helped take workers' rights away.
Oh, and voting rights.
Voting rights.
You know,
right?
I mean, he's been wrong on virtually everything that a mainstream Wisconsinite would care about. But they poured immense amounts of money in at the end, and they basically ran his campaign off right-wing talk radio, right, and a little bit of TV, and I presume some mailings. And it was highly effective in what is referred to as the Ring of Fire, the area around Milwaukee, where right-wing talk radio has some influence and where you have incredibly high Republican voting counties. Now, here's what's significant. They poured it on at the end. I mean, they got scared. I think, obviously, the numbers suggest they were wrong to be as unsettled as they were. But they got scared that he had done so little that there was potential that he didn't make it through. So they poured it on in those final weeks and effectively ran a general election campaign. Now, here's what's interesting. They only got him to around 45-46% of the vote. That's very significant, because it's hard to imagine anybody who voted for Tim Burns not voting for Rebecca Dallet. And then when you kind of pump up the turnout in places around the state, I think that, you know, I think you have a certainty of a very intense race for Supreme Court. B, I think a real potential that Dallet wins the thing.
Well,
not a certainty, by the way.
So 2 years ago, Joanne Kloppenburg was within a point of Rebecca Bradley. And then there was another candidate, an African-American candidate from Milwaukee, who got about 12%. And everybody was saying, hey, this is a great opportunity. Well, in came the money, and Joanne Kloppenburg was torn apart. But we also had a Republican and Democratic primary for president. That will not be happening this time.
Huge difference, and that's my point. That's the point I would make. Look, there's one other factor, too. What's your energy level, right? It's clear that energy levels for progressives and for Democrats are higher than they've been, maybe not on that primary night, but for an off-year spring election. I just think that
I don't mean to throw water on that. I think that's absolutely true. Yeah. We can talk about Kentucky in a moment.
Yes,
You know, in 2008, Democrats were pretty fired up, and there's this race between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. Now, I know John McCain and Mitt Romney were still running against each other in 2008 at that point. I can't remember.
No, there was some energy there. In fact, I think also, you know who else was still in the game?
Oh, Rick Santorum.
No.
Who was?
Well, I think Santorum was boy, I got to hope my history's right on this. How about Huckabee?
Oh, maybe Huckabee was still
making a play.
Okay. Well, all right, well, here's my point. You know, one of the worst god-awful justices ever elected, Michael Gableman, beat Lewis Butler on that day.
It's going to be a little harder for Skrenek to run a racist campaign against Dallet
right.
than it was for Gableman.
Oh, is that a racist campaign? Oh, I didn't know race was a factor in that.
In that race. It was awful. Gableman is one of the most reprehensible political players around. And his campaign, it's not like we're casually throwing the term racist around. It's nationally recognized.
Right.
As a racially charged.
You know, they barely found a candidate. He was like a last-minute throw-in after a bunch of people said no. Right, right.
Skrenik is like a low-level Gableman, right? You know, he's like a...
low-level.
It's like if Gableman didn't have his charm and quality.
I think his demeanor is a little kinder than Gableman's, but...
I guess so.
But that really is not saying a whole hell of a
no.
lot.
No. And so, you know, clearly, the weird part about the Republicans and the Walker administration, as regards the state Supreme Court is, you never really get the full measure of their disrespect for the court until you see the candidates they put up. And then you're like, whoa, they really do think they can elect anybody to the state Supreme Court. And in this case, they're making their effort with Skrenik. But I would say it's going to be very interesting to see where this thing goes forward. They're going to have to go, they'll decide to go hyper-negative on Dalit, and they'll look for some cases to highlight, and, you know, they always do. The challenge with Dalit is she's kind of a tough judge, and so it may not be as easy to generate those cases as in some circumstances. And Skrenik also has, you know, I don't know, Sly, how many Supreme Court justices do you know where their arrest photos are floating around?
That is unique. Let's put it that way.
I found that. I was sort of like, whoa, that's interesting.
Well, it was very nice of Scott Ross from One Wisconsin Now to post those.
Just share them with the people.
Right.
All I'm saying is, and also this story that came out right before the primary, and somehow I have a feeling it's going to resurface, of putting the 71-year-old guy in jail up in Sauk County because he wasn't a fan of child molestation.
Yeah, that may come back to
child
him.
Porn.
Right.
He was talking about.
Right. That may come back to haunt him.
Well, it's just weird. You know, I mean, I can fully understand. I respect Skrenik for, you know, you pull a juror over and you say, hey, that was inappropriate. You don't, you know, say you think somebody's a bad player before you've heard the whole case, stuff like that. And I respect that. You might even bounce a guy off the jury. But to put him in jail overnight? I mean, what's that about?
All right, let me ask you one more question.
Doesn't that make you want to show up for jury duty?
Right. By the way, I've never been called for jury duty.
And the people of Wisconsin thank the court system for that.
Let me ask you about Dane County, because Dalit almost beat Burns 2-1 in Dane County.
Yeah, it was a sweeping win.
Right?
Yeah. And if it wasn't for a couple of Isthmus precincts, highly political Isthmus precincts, Burns' total would have been significantly lower.
What do you think that says?
I think it says a couple things. And number one, interestingly enough, Burns ran against Walker and Walkerism. Dalit, to a much greater extent in her TV ads, ran against Trump and Trumpism. And as much as you and I may care about Scott Walker, and an awful lot of people do, and I think in general people have a discomfort with the guy, I think that Trump generates more energy. And so strategically, I think the ads that ran in the Madison area with basically positioning Dalit as somebody who would stand up to Trump, even though that's not exactly what the role of the Supreme Court justice is, I think that was very effective. I think people actually... That resonated with people. I had people say to me yesterday, I really like Dalit. And I said, well, why do you really like Dalit? And, you know, Trump would come up immediately.
Mm-hmm.
So that's very interesting. It was strategically interesting move. Secondly, she's a woman. And Dane County, to its tremendous credit, has, really had a history of embracing.
What was that headline in the Capital Times years ago? 20 years ago?
I can't remember.
I think it was Dame County.
and so the reality of Dane County is that this is a county that has produced Tammy Baldwin and Kathleen Falk as county executive and a statewide figure. Our legislative delegation has a substantial number of women represented in it.
Sue Bauman. You
know, well, Sue Bauman was mayor.
Right.
First woman mayor. And so all I'm saying is, I think this is a place that recognizes, quite legitimately, the need to advance women in our politics.
All right, we got to take.
So I think that did help a little.
John Nichols from the Capital Times and The Nation. We'll pick it up from there. Slysoffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers.
Injury lawyers Mike Riley and John Walsh.
When you hire a lawyer to help you with your personal injury, you want to know that you'll have that lawyer's personal attention. With John and I, that's exactly what you'll get. With many firms, the lawyer that you see in the ad is not the lawyer who's going to be representing you in the case.
One of the differences with Mike and my practice is that when you hire us, you'll have us personally involved in your case.
Call injury lawyers Mike Riley and John Walsh at 257-5661 for the personal attention you deserve.
Welcome back to SlysOffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers and our local sponsors like our friends at Madison Computer Works, S&R Remodeling, and the Axley Law Firm. All right, so John, let me ask you a little bit about what's going on right now in this country. These students at Parkland High School, the high school in Parkland, they're making quite an impact. Let me play this story from CBS because it is just amazing what has transpired here in the last couple days.
This is about a discussion. This is about us demanding change.
And 100 students from Stoneman Douglas High School boarded buses, taking their fight for gun reform to the state's capital, 450 miles away. Some students wrote lists of demands, including universal background checks and a ban on military-grade weapons. Their passion, palpable.
We will not rest until our voices are heard. We will not rest until people open their eyes and listen to us.
As they were sitting on the bus, Florida legislators voted down an attempt to revive a bill that would ban assault rifles. Students say they're not deterred.
But also, we're not going to let that vote down stop us. We are never going to stop pushing. And if it was introduced once, it could be introduced again.
Today, new photos from inside their closed.
What's going on out there?
I think there's a couple things going on, and they're all significant, not to be underestimated. Shootings that have occurred of late have had an absurdly poor response. Okay, you had the Las Vegas shooting, which was stunning. I mean, literally mowing people down. You know, dozens and dozens of people killed in a public setting in the middle of a major American city.
Out of the Mandalay Bay Hotel.
Yes, indeed. And so you just had no response whatsoever. They, you know, a little bit of talk about bump stocks, and then they didn't even move on it. And I think that there has been a slow recognition over the last number of years that initially the phrase hopes and prayers, you know, that Paul Ryan, other people would use, was a developed phrase. It was a term that they used with intent, i.e. to suggest concern, but not the likelihood of action. And for a time, that worked, right? People said, hey, yeah, we should pause and mourn, and that's appropriate. But didn't see anything come of it. Then the next stage was that you saw something horrible happen, and there was, you know, they're kind of some vague thing. Oh, maybe we'll do with bump stocks, but no real action. You know, again, now we had this horrible shooting in a location where you had a lot of young people, and that's the second part of what I'll say here. But we had this horrible shooting in an area where you had a lot of young people who were, you know, informed, engaged, interested, and who had, you know, grown up in this experience. Remember, these kids have seen school shootings their whole lives, and they trained to deal with school shootings. They knew how to, you know, hide and how to, you know, avoid, hopefully, you know, duck and get into a closet or do all the things you're supposed to do. And yet it didn't save their friends. You know, they knew that you know, all the sort of tactical and strategic things you would do aren't sufficient. And they also know that what politicians say isn't sufficient, right? That you need action. And so I think that that we may, and I emphasize the word may, we may have reached a tipping point where victims of an attack refuse to join in the dance, if you will, the performance that occurs after an attack, and instead are demanding, are knowingly demanding action.
Now, some have unwisely decided to attack students. Here's Mika Brzezinski talking about this this morning.
Some people who are attacking the outspoken student survivors for their activism and their voices. Among the most brutal was from author and filmmaker Dinesh D'Souza. After the Florida House voted down consideration of assault weapons ban, he tweeted, quote, "Adults one, kids zero." He also mocked a student who wept after the vote, tweeting, quote, "Worst news since their parents told them to get summer jobs." You know, I've known this guy since his days at the Dartmouth Review. I still don't understand him.
There was also another legislative staffer who said that the kids weren't real, that they were somehow trolling the situation. This is Diego Pfeiffer. He's a student. There at that high school, reacting to that.
The people that we left behind, the people that are no longer with us, they are not acting. They are dead. Now, my friends, I'm not going to be able to talk to them again. And to have that other people tell me that my mourn, my grief is not real, that I'm just acting it out, I would love to be that good of an actor. Trust me, I would. But I'm not. And this is real. We are all students there. Cameron Caskey, he's the one really leading us. David Hogg, Emma Gonzalez, none of us are talking with these adults. We're just going on these things. We're just talking out. We are making a change, and it is the students. We're not acting. This is real.
It's amazing that he had to say that.
Of course. And, you know, look, the painful part is that the people who are attacking these students, who are literally making things up, by the way, Emma Gonzalez tweeted something this morning about somebody who had sent out a tweet saying that one of these kids was a 26-year-old, you know, actor or 26-year-old political operative, right? You know, it's they, in this desperation zone, you see fake news in the classic sense come to a head because the defenders of the NRA at this point have nothing else. They have no... to use an inappropriate term, perhaps, ammunition. They have nothing to work with. And so they have to make stuff up. Or they have to try and belittle, besmirch, you know, play this game. At the end of the day, I don't think it's effective with anybody beyond their base. But I also don't think they care. I think that primarily what they care about is reinforcing their base and convincing their base that all this new criticism is a lie.
Two things going on here. The debate about guns and gun rights. But then there's the immediacy of this, and are our schools safe right now? And I noticed Chris Taylor, you know, put out that, you know, Republicans want armed guards at schools. Well, if they're talking about teachers, I think that's probably a bad idea. Teachers aren't trained to take on somebody with a semi-automatic assault weapon.
And they shouldn't be
okay.
Expected.
Right. On the other hand, you know, there were a lot of people in Madison pushing to get the Madison police out of our public schools, you know, because of the militarization of the police. Well, you know, I don't think having police at schools right now, guarding schools, is such a bad idea.
Well, as a parent, I don't mind it.
I don't mind having some more security at schools, because even if you were to ban semi-automatic assault rifles, which is unlikely to happen, there's 5 million of them in circulation, and there's kids getting expelled from schools every day that may have access to them.
Right, right. And, you know, there's a lot going on as regards violence in schools and challenges in schools. First off, you have had cases where the police have been brought in to the role of doing traditional discipline in the school. That shouldn't happen. That's a misappropriation of police resources. It is also, you know, it's a place where schools in some cases have not been dealing with the issues that they need to deal with, and they're putting it on the police. And so you do want to have a defined role if there's a police officer in a school. Their defined role is to keep people safe, right, to protect and serve. And I think you can do that. I think that's a doable reality. But what frightens me is, you know, State Representative Jesse Kramer and some other people pushing a line that, you know, boy, if you just kind of arm everybody, arm all these adults, you know, the teachers, I guess the janitors, you know, anybody, administrators, you're going to end up in a situation where somehow you can deal with it. And, you know, that's just not, their desperation, the desperation of that strategy.
You know how this shooting has, I'm a gun rights defender. I'm a Second Amendment supporter. I have never called for the ban of semi-automatic rifles, and that's complicated because there's many different kinds, and the last ban was riddled with contradictions and loopholes. But as far as I'm concerned, if, as a society, we're not willing to improve background checks, and we're not willing to take some steps to make it harder to get one for people that shouldn't have them, if we're not willing to secure schools, I mean, this is a failure of society to protect schools. That's just that's an out-and-out failure of society. My view on this is, if we're unable or unwilling to take those steps, I'd say yes, ban them, because they would be a menace to society. So, you know, nothing is static with me. If we're not willing to deal with this situation, then I'd say, yeah, ban them, or do what they do in Canada, which is probably a little more likely, and that is make people keep them at the gun range secure.
Yeah, I mean, look, here's.
See, you're making progress there, John.
Well, you know, I mean, look, this is an argument I've made for a long time, is that other countries deal with gun issues, and have a lot of gun ownership, have a lot of access to guns, but they don't have incidents like this. You know, look, this is an important thing to understand. I've been in countries where people are literally armed all over the place, right? You know, they go into schools, they go, you know, movie theaters, there's a lot of guns. Those are not necessarily peaceful countries, right? I've also been in countries with a lot of guns, and they have virtually no shootings, you know, of the kind we're talking about. I think the important thing is that there's a cultural side to this, there's a economic and social side to this, and there's a gun regulation side to this. These are all components. They ought to be taken seriously. The problem that we've got right now is that the entire debate about this issue is, it begins with somebody saying, or with a lot of folks saying, we're not going to look at all the possibilities. We're not going to look at every detail and figure out what's the best response. If you do look at all the possibilities, every detail of what the best response is, you're going to have to address some guns. You're going to have to talk about guns in some ways. And it may involve restrictions on some guns. It may involve, it certainly should involve background checks and, you know, all sorts of other vehicles for regulation in that regard. But when you have an absolute refusal to deal with basics, right, to say, yes, this is a big problem, our children are being slaughtered, we need to have an across-the-board response, then it becomes fine if people talk about other issues, you know, mental health, if they talk about, again, all sorts of other things, as long as they will let the guns be a part of the discourse. But they don't do that. And I actually think because they don't do that, they make the other, you end up with the other components getting lost in the mix as well. And my sense is that for 20 years now, we have not had an honest, functional debate about this. And I think these kids, these young people, are trying to say that's, you know, their entire lifetime we haven't had an honest debate.
Let me play one more clip, and I'll just, if you can give me a short answer after this. This is last night on the very fine Tucker Carlson show. I know you normally see it, but I think you missed it last night. So I'll just refresh. Here we go.
All of a sudden, you're seeing these kids involved in calls for very specific pieces of legislation. And the allegation has been that they are in some way in contact with organized anti-gun groups. And people who have suggested that have been denounced as immoral and heartless. And how dare you question these kids or attack them, which, for the record, I am certainly not doing.
Where their voices would be valuable is, where were the signs missed? These students were there. They That's dealt with this point. Kid every day. But the media's focused more on a teenager's expertise in supply side control measures for guns, which, Tucker, let's be candid, they probably have not studied a very complicated, layered issue.
That's Dan Bongino, former Secret Service agent who wrote a tell-all book attacking President Obama.
Yes, yeah.
That was nice, wasn't it?
The incredible thing about this is, I don't know if our Republican friends and our conservative friends recognize what's happening here, but boy, if you wanna turn an entire generation against you and your politics, they're doing the right thing.
John Nichols from the Capital Times and The Nation. Thanks for coming to SliceOffice.com.
SliceOffice.com.
Thanks a million.
Bye-bye.
You know, we work hard every day. In mills and mines, hospitals and schools, in office buildings, pharmacies and shipyards, factories and forests, in squad cars, ambulances and taxicabs. We do all kinds of jobs in Iowa, Wisconsin, Illinois, and all across the United States and Canada. We build the things that build our country. We do things that keep our country going, support our families and our communities. We have the courage to stand up even when no one else does. We have the strength to fight for what's right, for our families and for yours. We're your friends, your neighbors, your sisters and brothers. We're more than 1 million members strong. We stand in solidarity with workers in every continent on the globe. We're the United Steelworkers Union, and every day we fight for you. Please join our fight. Visit usw.org or like us at facebook.com/steelworkers.